Welcome to the Freedom Formula for Physicians podcast, where it's all about slashing your debt and taxes and creating a liberated lifestyle. And now, your host, with a love of fantasy books and funk, and a hatred of running more than 3 miles, Dave Denniston.
My name is Dave Denniston, your host, and welcome back to the latest episode of the Freedom Formula for Physicians podcast. And welcome back to our monthly fireside chat with a physician where we get to know their journey, their joys, and their struggles with finances and outside of finances. And you guys, this show isn't always about actionable content. It is, however, a chance for you to see behind the curtains, to walk in another person's shoes, to experience their lives. And our next guest was on the show last year. She gave us so much awesome, actionable advice on how to protect yourself from malpractice lawsuits before they can happen. And she's generous enough to share more with us and what we can learn from her. As a matter of fact, she is an emergency medicine doctor. However, she's also an author. And she's finishing her latest book, a fiction book, Schizo, Hidden in Plain Sight. She has a sequel in the works as well. She was kind enough to share a copy with me, and I am so excited for this book. I think every doctor can relate to this character, and if you need a little escape, a few hours of some exciting fun, you'll love this book. Anyhow, I can't wait to hear about her journey. Please help me welcome Dr. Eileen Benatore. Welcome, Eileen.
Hi, David. This is Eileen. How you doing?
Good, good, good. Well, so glad to have you back. And, you know, first I'd like you to tell us a little bit more about you. Where'd you grow up?
I grew up in New York, suburbs of New York City. It was about 45 minutes away in Rockland County. I'm not sure. Some people may have heard of that. And a little bit further than Westchester. And it was good.
Just outside the city. So I got to imagine, here's a question I want to write you. What did your childhood smell like?
Good. I mean, we were in the suburbs. We had a half acre of land and it wasn't, you wouldn't feel the city at all. It's the interesting thing about New York is you can be in the biggest city in the country and you go 40 minutes and you're in mountains, you're in, I wouldn't say rural anymore, but at the time it was semi-rural. You have the Westchester and you've got New Paltz and these beautiful mountains, all of it within an hour of New York City. So it's an interesting city from that perspective, is that you can be in the biggest city, but then you can be in nature.
Isn't that something? Yeah, I remember back graduating. Towards the end of graduating high school, we visited Cornell. So we visited New York City and drove out. And I totally relate to what you're saying, kind of rolling hills and a lot of rocky things out there. It didn't take that long once you got out of the city, like you said. So was that something you did often? Did you go to New York City quite a bit, or do you mostly stay out in the burbs?
My grandmother lived in New York City. So, yeah, we visited pretty frequently.
Huh. And what do you think your biggest influences were growing up?
Influences for what, I guess, specifically?
Well, just in terms of on your development, you know, was it your parents, grandparents, any experiences, you know, that shaped who you are?
Well, I think everyone has a part. I can think back. One of my grandmothers was really into, she lived in New York City, so we did a lot of the cultural stuff. So what museums and that kind of experience. So, and she was also very artistic and creative, and she's probably a big influence on part of the reason why I have that more creative side, in that she specifically told me, don't let your parents just make you a doctor. Make sure that you do all that other creative stuff that you do really well. Because I was doing poetry when I was in second grade, and I was doing photography and in high school and developing my own stuff. And I was doing some art and watercolors and you know, things along those lines that showed I had some creativity as well. And she just made it very clear that I shouldn't let my parents kill that, because they were so focused on, oh, we're going to have a doctor in the family. Don't let them kill that part of you, and make sure to express it and as much as possible. So I would say she was a big influence, but my other grandmother was very focused on, gosh, from the youngest age, I just always remember her handing me these books of just extra school material. Oh, yeah, do this and study hard. And so I think it was just a big focus. One grandfather died before I was born, the other when I was in fourth grade. So I don't remember my grandfathers too much, but my grandmothers definitely had a large influence. And, you know, of course, your parents, I mean, that goes without saying.
Right. Absolutely. So you had that artsy side to it. And I remember you told me before that your dad, I believe, was a malpractice attorney. Is that right?
Yes. Yes.
And so what was that influencing? Because you had the artsy side, and it sounds like you wanted to be in medicine. What did you always know that you wanted to be a doctor, or why did you want to become a doc?
I would say, when I don't know what age it changed, but if you asked me at earlier ages, I would have said I wanted to be an astronaut. I was very dedicated to that. And even when I was in med school, I remember going to a conference about space medicine, and I had seriously considered doing that instead of emergency medicine. And the biggest reason why I chose not to was space medicine was along the lines, technically it was like a preventative care residency, and it was not as active. I wanted more diversity and more hands-on care than would happen, even though intellectually I thought space medicine was just pretty cool. But if you ask me early on, it was definitely, I wanted to be an astronaut. I saw the space shuttle launch for the first time. I saw the space shuttle blow up live, because I think I was homesick that day and I was watching it on TV. It was a huge influence on my life, and I was fascinated by space. I just finished a book called Seven Eves by Neal Stephenson, where he talks about a scenario where the world blows up. I mean, the moon blows up, and then it has consequences, of course, for humanity, and the space program becomes a huge part of that book. So, I'm still fascinated by all of that. That hasn't changed a lot. But as I said in the previous podcast, I think my father's bringing home his work, talking about the cases, and hiring me on to search for things within his files to help him, I think that got me fascinated about medicine, because I love mysteries. That's the other thing. I would read every single mystery out of the library at school, and that's what medicine is. That's what I discovered, was medicine, every person is its own little mystery. Every case is its own little mystery. And that definitely hit all the right buttons in me. It didn't hurt that my parents were also very supportive of such an endeavor, having their daughter be a doctor. But that wasn't the reason at all. In fact, I think I really questioned it at some point in college. Like, do I really want to be a doctor, or do my parents want me to be a doctor? And I realized after doing an internship, I definitely wanted to be a doctor.
Well, take me back to that moment. Was there a big conflict then in you? You know, it sounds like there was a lot of tension there.
Well, sure. As I said, the creative aspects were taking over. I was in college and I was exploring things. I was taking art history and photography, video. I was making documentaries and mini movies. I was doing a lot of artistic stuff, and I realized that I was pretty good at it. And started questioning, do I really want to be a doctor? Organic chemistry is boring. And, all those things that you question when you're in college, that everything you thought you wanted, do you really want that? And so I did they had a summer program at a hospital near where I lived for pre-medicine students like myself, and see if you really like it. And you rotated through all the departments. You rotated through, I remember you spend a week in the ER and a week, I can't remember all the other sections of it, but I remember that week in the emergency department was so key for me. I just loved it, just absolutely loved it, and said, yes, I want to be a doctor. Although I didn't think at that time I wanted to be in the emergency department, I actually took away from that experience that I wanted to be a pediatrician. And it wasn't until medical school that I realized, while I love kids, I didn't really love pediatrics. I didn't like the medicine of pediatrics as much. I do it, obviously. I see kids all the time in my emergency department, but that's not my favorite part of emergency medicine. And I didn't want to only do emergency pediatrics. And so somewhere along the line in med school, that was a shift as well. And I thought back to that original internship and how much I loved that. And I was like, oh, well, I didn't just love medicine. I love being in the emergency department. I love the freedom of it. And one of the female doctors there told me, she said, being in emergency medicine is great. You can have a family. You can have a life. You can travel. You can have time off. You can do other pursuits, the things that you like to do, and you can do medicine and kind of have the best of both worlds.
And do you feel that way today? I mean, is that still true for you now? Do you feel that that's the case?
Absolutely. I work what most people would consider part-time hours, even though it's a full-time paycheck, I guess. And yeah, I work less than most other emergency physicians. I definitely work less than most humans in as far as just hours at the job. But that allows me to have time to do the other stuff. The writing
is
a big part of it.
Well, that's a great segue into to tell us about being that author. You know, so I can see that mystery in you that you love that sense. You love books. You love art, so that's really, really cool. Tell us about that journey about medicine and authorship. You know, is that something you've always wanted to do, be an author, and you've just put that on hold for a while? You know, what's that been like?
Well, I went to a high school where the school I was in, everybody was pretty advanced that I was around. I didn't realize until now that I have a kid in high school how unique my school was. And I see it on Facebook. I see all these kids who were in my classes, and they're all just super smart, successful people. And I was in not just honors classes, but they had honors accelerated. And they didn't just have one class of us. They had like probably four classes. Packed 20-something kids per class, all who were honors accelerated just like me. So I didn't think it was weird or abnormal. It wasn't something special. It wasn't a gifted track. It was sort of, this is what you did when you needed more stimulation, I suppose. And there were a lot of us. So I didn't think I was anything extraordinary, especially with writing. I thought I was pretty ordinary with my writing. And I did what I needed to do to get a good grade, but I didn't think anything of it. I did always have a love for words. And as I think I said, I was writing. I was obsessed by poetry when I was in second grade. I remember writing all kinds of poetry. I'd make my own cards for my family members and write my own little sayings on the inside of it instead of searching for a card to buy. And from an early age, I remember doing that. And so clearly I was interested in writing. My dad was an English major, so grammar was very important. Spelling was very important. Learning how to just speak properly and write properly was a very important thing, and you got corrected if you didn't do it right. It was when I went to college, and ironically enough, it was a biology class where I realized I had some writing talent. It was an upper-level biology class that was actually more of a writing class and an ethics class. And what you did is they took ethical issues about biology, and you wrote essays. And the essays were graded by your peers, and you had to submit a writing sample just to qualify for the class. There were about 10 of us in the class, and you'd write an essay, and then your peers graded you on a scale of 1 to 3, the best paper they read, the middle, and the worst paper they read. And then your grade was based on a tally of how many 3s, 2s, and 1s you got. And what I realized is I consistently on every single paper got 3s with an occasional 2. I didn't get any 1s. And in a class full of people who were good writers, and you had to qualify for that, I was kind of one of the tops in the class. And that's where it occurred to me, I might actually be good at this. I didn't think I was anything but a good test taker who accomplished what she needed for a test or an essay for a report. I didn't think I really could do much more than that until this class. And it stayed in the back of my mind that if I had an idea and I had the time, I would like to write more. But that really didn't happen until after college. I took a year off after college before med school. And during that year off is when I started my first book. And so this was something that I actually started before medical school. And during medical school, I continued it to a certain degree, but I didn't have time to really write that much, so I did a lot of poetry. Right. I wrote a lot of poetry in med school, submitted it to, I think we had a newsletter and some sort of thing that I would submit it to for the medical school. But mostly that's what I did, and occasionally actually worked on the book. And that particular book took me so long, and it was set in the future, that the future started happening. And as I learned more about writing and got better at it, at a certain point I realized that that book needed to be abandoned. It wasn't as relevant and it wasn't worth fixing. And so I just moved on to other projects. And in my head, I've always got like 7 or 8 books in my head that I want to write sometime when I'm ready to write them. And it was in medical school that I had an idea for this particular book that I'm getting published in September, the Schizo Hidden in Plain Sight. That idea germinated in, 1996, 97, somewhere around there. So it was something that was in my head for a few decades almost before I started writing it.
That's a long pregnancy. Longest pregnancy ever, 20 years.
it just would stay in the back of my mind, but I had other priorities. I had other things I wanted to write first. And I remember when I finished med school and I was studying for my boards, I got really hyped up about healthcare reform. And in the middle of studying, I just stopped studying one day and started writing a book on healthcare reform. And I wrote the book and I submitted it for publication, and I got an agent actually, and she was really dedicated to it, but we couldn't sell it because what we realized is people want healthcare reform, but no one wants to read about it. And even Newt Gingrich, with his book and his name behind it, he couldn't barely sell the book either. So healthcare reform just wasn't something that was as sellable. But what I realized was it also made good fodder for a blog, so I was able to take bits and pieces from the research I had done for the book, plus pieces of the book, and a lot of what I did in that book ends up in some form on my blog, because the material got used, at least a lot of the material got used So it wasn't a complete waste of time, but it also taught me a lot about the business of publishing and what is required to get a book published. And I took during the course of that book, I went to a conference called Medical Fiction Writing for Physicians. And it was taught by Michael Palmer and Tess Gerritsen, two fiction medical thriller authors. Michael Palmer died last year, actually. And he's an emergency physician. She's an internal medicine physician. And so it was a great conference. And they had, before the conference, a pre-conference for nonfiction writers. So I was really going for the nonfiction part of it to see what I could learn to maybe better market my book, better write my book, because I don't think I was 100% done at that time. But I decided while I was there, I might as well do the fiction part and maybe I'll learn something. And what I learned is I didn't know how much I didn't know I needed to know, if that makes any sense. And it was such an eye-opening course, both from a marketing perspective, but also just a learning perspective. And while I was at that conference, I was also in the middle of a fiction book and a screenplay for that fiction book. I was doing both at the same time. So I was really writing three books at the same time while...
Oh, my word.
While studying for my boards. And I had taken like 3 months off before the boards. And this course helped focus me in, and the next book I wrote, that fiction book, when I finished it, the second half was much better than the first half. And I have discovered that it's very hard to rewrite something to be better than having something that has a good structure from the beginning and making that the best it can be. Mm. And when I finished it, it was okay. It was an okay book, but it wasn't anything I wanted to put out there to under my name, or it just I didn't think it was my best effort. I just knew that it was getting me there. Each time I wrote something, I got better. So this book, Schizo, is really probably 1, 2, 3. This is really my fourth book that I've written. Huh. It's just my first fiction novel that I'll be publishing.
All right. Well, let's take a pause here for a second and go to our commercial break. Well, if you are like most members of my audience, you are committed to being an amazing doctor and succeeding at life. But the truth is, you have never received financial training during medical school, and you struggle with enough time to do it all. And maybe you even made a few mistakes along the way. And that's exactly why I wrote my book, 10 Critical Mistakes Doctors Make with Their Money, and the brand new ebook, 5 Steps to Overcome Common Physician Financial Mistakes. As a matter of fact, you can't buy 5 Steps to Overcome, but you can get the entire ebook for free by subscribing to my free email newsletter at www.drfreedompodcast.com. My email newsletter lets you know once or twice a month whenever I posted fresh content to my podcast, so you don't always have to visit my podcast website. Plus, my newsletter subscribers, they get a first crack at exclusive offers and lots of free stuff. You can get the whole copy of 10 Critical Mistakes and your free copy of 5 Steps to Overcome Common Physician Financial Mistakes ebook by visiting drfreedompodcast.com and enter the form on the page.
So let's just stop for a second. I just want you to reflect on that time. I mean, why was it so important to you to write? Was it that it was an outlet for you? Was it just organizing your thoughts? I mean, why be an author?
Well, I don't know what other creative types are like, but I know that with me, I got a lot of things swirling around in my brain, and the only way to get it out, to stop having it swirl, is to write, get it out of my brain. and have it go away. So writing stops that. So it's therapeutic in a way, I guess. You know, a lot of people have insomnia and have trouble sleeping, and they have racing thoughts, and they're always thinking about stuff. And for me, the solution for that is writing. I don't have insomnia, although I do have weird hours. I do sleep well. I just do it at weird times. And I'm not an anxious person. And I think a lot of that is because I do have an outlet, more than one outlet. Photography is a huge hobby of mine as well. That hadn't changed. But I needed more than just photography. I needed the verbal outlet to get the stuff inside out, and writing accomplished it. And it also created another thing for me that was very important for my psychological well-being, which was it gave me a new goal. As someone who was dedicated to being a doctor, it's a lot of mental effort to resign yourself to all the work that's required to become a doctor. And when you're done, when you're finally done, it's very anticlimactic. It's yay, I'm done. And then it's, okay, so what do I do now? So I'm a doctor. I don't have any tests other than, well, you have some yearly things, but it's nothing big. And every 10 years you have a huge test, and it's not something you want to take. But that goal-orientedness is such a big part of being a doctor. And I have friends who had a similar problem and solved it by getting further education. They got another degree. They got an MPH. They did a fellowship. They got another residency. They couldn't stop. They couldn't stop learning and having that goal. And I realized the madness did have to stop. I did not want to keep getting degrees. I had more than enough. And for the healthcare book, my friend was going through MPH school at the time, and I think I borrowed about half of her book. So I was unofficially giving myself part of an MPH degree just on my own by reading up on it to learn as much as possible about public health, because that's what healthcare reform is all about. It's about public health. So I was still educating myself, but I knew that the madness had to stop. But I needed a goal. And then writing helped that tremendously, because you have another chapter.
Yes.
You have a
conflict. The book itself, right?
And
the book
I have
itself.
An editor that I work with who is, it's like going to your own personal teacher, and you have rewards. Like, oh, you did a great job. This chapter only had 5 things written on it, and usually every line has a little bit of red. So when you only have a little bit of red, it's very satisfying that you're getting better, that in the beginning of the book, there's a lot of red, and as you progress, you're having less and less because you're learning. And so it gave me a new way to learn and improve without the madness of having to get another degree just because you couldn't stop. And I do think that's a problem for doctors, and that they can't stop learning, which is good, but it's also bad because you have to stop the madness. Sometimes you have to stop going to school. Some people can't stop, but I set a line. I was not going to get any more degrees. So this helped tremendously to have that goal. And there's always something, because once you've written the book, then you're spending a lot of time trying to market it and get an agent, get a publisher. Once you have a publisher, now you have to get your platform in order, make sure that you're out there on social media and that you're submitting for reviews and you're creating a website and all the other stuff behind the scenes that goes with it. So there's so much to do for this goal of yours that it more than satisfies that intellectual curiosity and goal-orientedness that I personally need in order to be sane, you know, just have something to do.
something to grow with. No, I totally respect that. I think one of the things as an author, that'd be great to give people behind the scenes, behind the curtain kind of look as you've looked at writing and have writing this book, is this whole discussion today of self-publishing versus publishing through a publishing house. So could you compare and contrast those two experiences? You know, how do you look at that? And why did you choose to do a publisher for the latest book?
Sure. I would say, well, first of all, I actually wrote an article on this very recently, and it's posted to my Goodreads account. So if anyone wants to read some of my thoughts on writing, you can find me on Goodreads under my name, Eileen B. Benator. That's my writing name versus my doctor name, which is Dr. Brenner. So I'm basically two people, and I have a book under Eileen Brenner, which is the malpractice book, and now I've got this novel under my married name, Eileen B. Benator. So you can find me under Goodreads there, and I'll have more than just what, this topic up there. I have got a whole bunch of articles up. But I can tell you in more detail that self-publishing is a good idea for people who are, say, in business and they do consulting work and they already have speaking engagements all around the country or even all around where they live, but they're guaranteed to be speaking in front of a lot of people on a specific topic, and they could increase the marketability of their consulting by having a book, and they could also increase their income by having a book to sell, because if you give a talk and people like it, then they want more. And, oh, I have more. Here's a book. And you can sell it. So self-publishing works great for that because you can do it instantly. To sell a book into a publisher is a multi-year. It's a process. And if you are already established out there speaking, and what I would do is I would hire a personal editor like I have to help you with a book and get it out there, and you do self-publishing, and now people can buy it. They can buy it on Amazon. You can do print on demand, all kinds of ways that you can get a book out there quickly. However, if you do anything but that situation, then there's different kinds of nonfiction. There's mass market nonfiction, such as those diet books or I know someone who wrote a book about preemies, and that's obviously a more of a mass market thing. There's lots of people who have babies and lots of people who have preemies, and so that's kind of a mass market thing. My book was more of a targeted book, not mass market. It was more of an academic type of a book, and it was published by an academic publisher, and it was geared towards doctors. And not mass market, not and I would have someone say, hey, can I buy your book? And I'm just like, sure, but you're not a doctor. I'm not really sure what you still have of it. Maybe a lawyer might be curious about it, but even lawyers might not really care so much about it because it was written by a doctor. So it was really a book by a doctor for doctors about the legal process. And so it was not something I needed necessarily an agent for, and I was able to get that directly through the publisher. But if you want the quality, you want their distributors, publishers have huge advantages over self-publishing. But if you already have distribution of your own, which is you speak around the country already and people want to buy something from you, then you can save a lot of time. But there is a quality issue. Remember, I did have a personal editor, and she was great.
Yes.
And she wasn't just good on content. She was good about grammar and helping make sure that things were good. But even with that, I've gone through 3 rounds of editors in addition to her, and they all found a zillion things, little tiny things, commas and quotes and hyphens and things that she missed and I missed. And the first editor would correct a ton of stuff, and then the second editor would find more. And so that's why no matter how good you think your project is, publishers will make it better. Even if you're not a top writer, publishers will make it better. And if you listen to any author that you've ever admired, for me, James Michener is one, and Stephen King, Dean Koontz, they all speak or have spoken in the past about their writing process. Michael Palmer in his course, and Tess Gerritsen, they all said the same thing, which is they would not be the kind of writers they are were it not for the excellent editors at their publishers. Mm. And so they may be very good at telling a story and writing very well, but it's that editor that makes it exceptional. And so if you publish it on your own, there is a decline in quality, hence the reason why you usually can't sell it for as much money as it would be if it came from a publisher.
Sure.
You can find good content online that's not through a publisher. You can find all kinds of books on Amazon, but it's just not going to be as polished. And
so it really sounds like, you know, if I just could sum up real quick for you, that self-publishing is great if you have a platform or you're building a platform, you're doing something like consulting. But for you, the reason why you've chosen to do the publishers is because there's a whole system in place. There's people to look over it, people to make it as high quality as possible.
And then if you need – and then for distribution, obviously if you are self-published and you can sell it to people that you speak to, that's a form of distribution, and that works for you. But if you want to reach a larger audience, publishers who have been there, they have access to professional distributors, and they get there. That's how you get your book in Walmart. That's how you get your book in the airport, in Publix, and all these places that you see books being sold. That happened through a distributor, and you, the individual, do not have access to that distribution chain. You have to be represented by a legitimate publisher. And
absolutely,
that is huge. That distribution chain is absolutely huge. So that alone is a reason to have a publisher. If you don't have your own distribution, which most people don't, and even if you do have a product, like what I would recommend for some people, like business people, I might recommend write a book. If you need it quickly, self-publish it and sell a lot of them. And if you sell enough of them, then a real publisher would be more willing to take you on because you have your known quantity, and then they can really bump you up to the next level. So that's something you could do if you wanted immediate satisfaction. But some publishers won't want to touch you because you already have a product out there. Others will like the fact that you have a product out there and want to take it to the next level. But that distribution chain is huge. And so while I do have a platform, it's nothing that I can't sell that a huge amount of books on my own. I need a publisher. And my editor, I remember going back to her because it took a number of years to get this particular book sold. The malpractice book I sold almost instantly. I took 6 months off from work. I wrote the book, and then I submitted it to publishers directly, and I got a response really quickly, maybe 2 months into the process. So I got a publisher pretty quick on that one. The fiction has taken me a lot longer. There's a lot of rejections, and if I had started writing now, I think it would have gotten published faster. Because modern publishers accept email queries, and you can email 60 people at one time, and you can get all kinds of responses, and then you can then send your project. You don't have to print it out and send it in the mail anymore.
You just email it instead, right? Which makes it so much quicker for them to look over and get a feel for it. Well, tell
us
real quick about Schizo, Hidden Plain Sight. Tell us about this multi-year process you've been through. You know, what was the inspiration behind it, and when is it coming out?
Well, again, in the 90s, when I was in med school, I was on my psychiatry rotation, and I had some very fascinating patients. And I just, I had an idea for, based on some stuff that I had learned about schizophrenia and some patients with some very vivid delusions, I had an idea, kind of, you know, what if idea. And that's one of the things I learned in that course I took, which was when you're getting an idea, all you need to start a book is what if. And and if you can create a what if idea, you can write a book. And I before I had taken the course, I had created my what if idea, and it just, like I said, just stayed in the back of my mind, and every now and then I would think about it and just move on. But it was something I wanted to develop into a book. And in this book, Schizo, there's a med student, and I actually write from a male perspective in the first person, even though I'm obviously a female. And
yeah,
the main character, Dan Greenberg, is a med student who wants to go into surgery. And he starts off his rotation in psychiatry. And this is kind of an easy rotation, nice way to start off the year if you're going to be a surgeon, because not much is going to be easy for you once you're in surgery. And in this rotation, he has two very notable patients, one named Catherine, who's a schizophrenic, and one who is actually a murderer who's in the forensic ward. And they're in separate parts of the same hospital. And Catherine has these very vivid delusions about patients who are in danger all around Chicago in hospitals. And she's so specific, she gives hospital room numbers. And Danny, he calls, and he feels compelled out of compassion that, well, what if this lady isn't crazy? What if she's psychic or something like that? And so he calls, and these patients aren't in those rooms, and he feels much better, and life is good, and everything's great. Until one day, he goes to a hospital as just a friend of a patient, just to cheer him up. He had his appendix removed, and he happens to come upon one of the patients that this crazy person had told him, and they were there at that hospital. And he had written down all the information he sees, like same patient, same hospital, same room number. So the timing was off, though. She didn't, when she gave the name, they weren't there, but days later they were. And that made him think, are all these other patients in hospitals? And if they are they in danger? Why are they in danger? What's going on? And so that begins the book. He is investigating all of this. And as a process of investigating this, he sets off a lot of red flags, because they are in danger, and they're in danger because there is an organized plot to control the population. And when you say things like that and you're a schizophrenic, it sounds like you're crazy, but sometimes stuff like that is true. And so he then ends up as a patient in that same psychiatric ward. And while he's there, that's where he joins up with another patient of his. That murderer is his age, and they actually become friends, and both of them conspire to try to escape.
What I thought was so fun about the book, I read about the first 50 pages or so, and you have this whole past and present, you know, flashbacks. So it played just like a movie. I just love the structure of that, because it builds that mystery. You know, what happened? How did this come about? So I thought that was really well done. Now, what I'd like to focus on just for this next few minutes before we wrap up is, obviously, this is a show we focus a lot on finances. And there's a lot of financial choices involved as a doctor, as an author. So I'd just be curious to find out two questions for you. What is the best piece of financial advice you've received? And secondly, what's the worst piece of advice that you've heard or been told?
Well, gosh, there's so many bad finance advice. I'll just give you some two personal anecdotes from my parents. My parents gave me some very good advice. regarding finances and some very bad advice regarding finances. So one of the good advice they gave me was pay yourself first. In other words, it is so easy to just spend every penny that comes in, no matter how much money you make, you just have higher expenses. And you can find a way to spend everything you earn. So the best way to prevent that is to automatically have savings debited from your account. And just every month it comes out and you don't even think about it. And that is the best way to save money, is to force yourself to save by having it be automatic. And then you only spend what's available. And even if you spend every penny of what you earn that month that shows up in your account, you are actually still saved a lot of money. And so maxing out your 401k, if you can do that, and just putting money away without thinking is the best way to go about things. And I have found that to be very true. And I do listen to that. As far as the bad advice, and I don't know if this was different back then or they just weren't thinking about it right. My parents were always obsessed about their credit limit. And if they got their credit limit raised, they would call the credit card company and say, I don't want this much money accessible. I want you to lower my credit back to what it was before. I don't want $10,000, $20,000 worth of credit. I only want $1,000 because I'm good with that, or whatever it was that they were comfortable with. And they didn't have many credit cards. They spent a lot of money in cash. And they said, the reason they said they did this was because they knew they were going to need to get a mortgage because we were going to move. And they wanted to have the best credit rating possible. So they didn't want a lot of credit available. But that's actually really bad advice.
Yes, the opposite.
It's the opposite, right. So, but it's counterintuitive, and I've actually spoken to a number of doctor friends of mine who are asking me for advice since I had bought a house very early on. I bought one just after med school, before I started residency, I bought a townhouse, and everyone else I went to school with was renting. I was the only one who bought anything. And so people came to me for advice, and they were kind of asking me the same thing, saying, everyone tells me I need to close out my credit cards in order to have a good credit rating. And what do you think? And I said, no, don't listen to them.
Right.
I said, no, that's the worst advice ever. The way they calculate your credit rating is available credit versus used credit. So if you have 10 credit cards, and you have $10,000 worth of credit on each credit card, that's $100,000 worth of credit. But if you only use $2,000 a month of credit, then you have a huge ratio, and that's great, and you'll have a great credit rating. But if you only have one card with a $5,000 limit, but you max out that credit every month, they're going to see that you use all the credit you have, and you're going to have a much lower rating. And so that advice I was given by my mom, and his very popular form of advice, was very, very bad. And I was fortunate to have learned it from someone else somewhere along the line, or maybe a show. Somewhere I learned not that they were wrong, and so I was doing it the right way. But it is true, though, if you're about to get a mortgage, don't open up a lot of credit cards, because that will lower your credit. But you don't want to suddenly close out all your credit cards because you're about to get a mortgage. That's the worst thing that you could do. The best thing is let your credit limit go up organically and don't spend any more money. And so as it goes up, your ratio goes up and your credit limit goes up. And that's a great way to improve your credit.
Yeah, those are two great points, everybody. So make sure to write those down. Number one, pay yourself first. Whether it's in a 401k or some sort of outside account, get the money out of your pocket. Absolutely. Then number two, in order to increase your credit score, don't keep your number of credit cards as well as the limits down. You want to make sure to get those up. So if you're a resident, if you're a fellow, if you don't have a credit card, now's a great time to get going. Not that you have to use all of it and maybe you just sock it away, but just so you have it open and you can start building your credit. Well, Thanks so much for being with us, Eileen. If people have more questions, where can they find you? Where can they get a copy of Schizo when it comes out?
Well, I would definitely appreciate as many pre-orders as possible. You can find me on Amazon. Again, you can, if you're in Amazon, just type in Schizo, and my book is like the third thing down with that name, or just Google, or just put my name in there, Eileen B. Benatore, and you'll find my book on Amazon to pre-order. But as far as where to find me and my writings, I'm kind of all over the place. I'm still developing a website. I've got a professional designer who's come up with this great, great idea, and it'll probably be live at the end of April. So in the meantime, I have a website more towards the doctor stuff, drbrenner.blogspot.com. It has a lot of stuff on it, medically oriented, more about the previous book. And, of course, I'm on Twitter. And for Twitter, I'm IB Benatore, if you want to find me there.
Okay, great. And we're going to include those, everyone, on the show notes page. So make sure to check that out. That way you can get all to Eileen's information and find out her book and everything else. Well, this is Dave Denniston, and let me just say I would love to tell your story next. It would be my honor to host you on the next podcast so we can learn from your journey and help other doctors. After all, who better to speak to a physician than another physician? So I think there's some awesome stuff that Eileen taught us today, and I would encourage everyone to check out the book. You're going to love it. If you have more questions, make sure to contact me at dave@daviddenniston.com or on my website, drfreedompodcast.com. For the Freedom Formula for Physicians podcast, this is Dave Denniston. Thank you so much for joining us. Make sure to subscribe and check in again soon. Have a good one.
Hey, this is Dave Denniston. I hope you liked today's episode. I'd love to hear your feedback. If you did like it and you want some more ideas on achieving financial freedom, visit the podcast website at www.drfreedompodcast.com. That's www.drfreedompodcast.com. And when you subscribe to my newsletter, you'll get a free copy of my ultra-popular ebook, 10 Critical Mistakes Doctors Make With Their Money. Go ahead and check out www.drfreedompodcast.com and snag a copy of your ebook now.